Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Thank you very much for being here tonight. It's very nice to see all of you. I assume everybody's in California with the exception of Giuseppe. So I'm very sorry, you know, for all the wildfires and, you know, in addition to everything that's going on. I was looking at some pictures yesterday of the sky of San Francisco and how bad the air quality is. So I'm thinking about all of you, and I have you in my heart. So the title of my talk tonight, as Bonnie said, is What is Power? And first of all, I want to say thank you to all of you for attending the talk and for supporting me and all the priests in training at Canando every Wednesday evening. And I'm very glad that Les was able to attend tonight too. I am always happy and grateful for his wisdom and guidance. I would like to start by reading a short poem. And the poem says, "When a bird sings, the mountain becomes more calm. When a bird sings, the mountain becomes more calm." And it's a poem that Suzuki Roshi read at the beginning of one of his Dharma talks in the early 70s in Tassajara. And it made me think about the week when, well, we went there twice, but especially the first time that I was there, it was very special. So it made me feel and think about the week we were there with all of you, and how beautiful it is when one is able to feel the silence of a mountain. So last week, I attended the online conference of the Soto Zen Buddhist Association. And the theme of the conference was Zen, Love, and Resilience, Our Role in a Chaotic World. During one of the breakout groups, we were asked the question, what is power? And some of the answers that came up were, power is the ability to make or influence decisions or change. Power depends on the circumstances, says somebody else. A teacher might have power at the sendo, but not at the doctor's office if he or she gets sick. Power is something we give away, said somebody else. We met only for a few minutes, so there weren't too many answers, but one of them stayed with me. It came from a Japanese priest who was attending the conference, and he said, power is something we don't know we have. Power is something we don't know we have. And there wasn't any time to follow up, or obviously there wasn't the chance to meet in person. So we moved to the next activity on the schedule, and I didn't get the chance to talk to that priest again, but his answer though stayed with me. I thought someone who says power is something we don't know we have may after all know something about it. So what is power? Why do some people have a powerful presence? How do we access our power? How do we discover it? Am I in touch with my own power? What does our practice, those who came before us, teach us about it? those were some of the questions that crossed my mind. Being at a Zen conference, I wondered not only about my power as an individual, but also as a Zen student, a priest in training, as a member of a community, a Sangha, and also about our power in the deepest universal sense. Is it important to know or not? Maybe not. In 2 years from now, in 2022, Zen in America will turn 100, celebrating the opening of the first Zen temple in North America in 1922 in Los Angeles, the Zen Shuji Soto Mission. It was moving to see, during a presentation at the recent Soto Zen conference, the pictures of those first Japanese teachers arriving to the US. Especially, I was moved to see the picture of Suzuki Roshi walking outside San Francisco Zen Center soon after his arrival in the mid-50s. When I saw his picture, I thought that as Suzuki Roshi was walking outside San Francisco Zen Center, our teacher at Canon Dolles was also taking steps that one day will lead to his meeting with Suzuki. And eventually, I too would start taking the first steps of my long journey to California to an encounter with a Zen teacher and his teacher and the teachers that came before them. Their courage, determination, their practice, the stories they shared encourage us to believe in our own power, to rely on our effort and direct experience, to rely on the power of Zazen. In an interview with French television network Arte, Zen Master Miyazaki Senji, the 78th abbot of a Heiji monastery in Japan, who passed away in January of 2008, when he was 106 years old, he said, and I'm quoting, "Dogen showed us the way. The sitting posture of meditation teaches us to lead a righteous life, even if it seems difficult to us. We are far too preoccupied with honors, social positions, vanity, selfishness, and all kinds of things. But we have to learn to overcome our desires. And for that, there is Zazen." And I thought, wow, isn't it wonderful to have that experience during Zazen when there is no place for desires and we are just devoted to each breath. I do believe that if our body is right, so will our mind. Reverend Miyazaki started sitting Zazen when he was 11, and he kept practicing to the end of his life, in total 19 years of Zazen. Priests in training at Eiheiji remember how when they got to the Zendo in the morning to light incense or set up the altar, he was already there, sitting in the darkness with one of his attendants. And that made me think of the white Subaru in the parking lot of Kanondo that we could count on every morning. And also made me think how grateful I am for all the mornings that I spent sitting in silence with many of you. A few weeks ago, I shared with you what I think is a powerful story. It's a story about Master Nansen, an 8th century Chinese master. When he was about to die, he was asked by one of his students, "Where will the master be gone to in 100 years' time?" And Master Nansen replied, "I will be a water buffalo at the bottom of that mountain." And what I think he meant to express with that was his vow to serve, his bodhisattva vow to save all beings. Water buffaloes are called the living tractors of the East because of their enormous strength. And this summer, I have been going to a beach nearby to swim, and sometimes for exercise purposes, I walk against the tide, and that requires a lot of strength. So while doing that, many times this summer, the image of the water buffalo came to mind, and it occurred to me that one has to be strong to save oneself, and more so to save all beings. In one of those early 70s Dharma talks at Tassajara, Suzuki Roshi said that we need to first understand our human nature and the true meaning of our life, our hunger and selfishness, in order to help others. And I really think that's true. I was having a conversation with Les recently, telling him that, you know, it's been kind of a challenge for me to sit by myself without the support of a Sangha. And he reminded me of these stories that are common in Zen literature about the sage that is sitting in the mountain and that, you know, has all the wisdom. And he said, you know, it takes determination to get that kind of understanding. So having spiritual friends like all of you helps to maintain that determination. I think everything is easier, as the song says, with a little help from our friends. At the end of October, Mushin Patricia Ikeda, she is the co-founder of East Bay Meditation Center in Oakland and a longtime socially engaged Buddhist activist, will be a guest speaker at our online sendo. And she is a big believer in the power of a spiritual community, the power of Sangha. For Mushin, our own survival depends on the creation of beloved community, a term that was used during the civil rights movement by Reverend Martin Luther King, who envisioned a society based on justice, equal opportunity, and love of one's fellow human beings. Beloved community describes a society in which all are embraced and none discriminated against. And I enjoyed reading the opinions of Thich Nhat Hanh about Sangha. He believes that the Buddha of the future, Maitreya, the Buddha of love, will not be an individual but a community. And in a beautiful Dharma talk given in 1997, titled Sangha, he said, "The Sangha is your protection. It is the raft that will carry you to the shore of liberation." And he continued, "A Sangha that practices love and compassion together is the Buddha we need for the 21st century. It is up to us to bring the next Buddha into existence, Maitreya, the Buddha of love. We have the privilege and the duty to prepare the ground for bringing that Buddha to life, for our sake and the sake of our children and our planet. Each of us has a role to play. Each of us can bring the Buddha into our daily life by practicing mindful living. Each of us is a cell in Maitreya Buddha, the Buddha of the 21st century, the Buddha of love." So that is what Thich Nhat Hanh believes, and it's nice to think about the power we have as members of a Sangha. And to end, I would like to read something from the diaries of Reverend Miyazaki Senji, the abbot of Heiji that I mentioned before. He kept a daily diary where he wrote on which day of which month certain flowers bloom, and on which day of which month certain insects start their activity. And in his diaries, he wrote, "Year after year, these dates remain almost the same. That's Dharma. Great nature is in accordance with Dharma, quietly carrying out the truth. That's how great nature is. Nature does not seek to be admired or praised. There is no reward, regardless of how much work it does. At a certain time, flowers bloom. With or without praise, they do what they have to do. When the time comes, they live quietly. That's what being is. That is practice, teaching the truth." According to him, we should live imitating nature. He said, "The blessings of nature unfold in meditation." And I was surprised to read that he believes that a few minutes in the morning are enough. So tonight, this morning here in Spain, I am grateful to Reverend Gyokei Yokoyama, a Japanese priest living and teaching in New York, who, during the Soto Zen Buddhist Association conference last week, said, "Power is something we don't know we have." He trained at the Heiji when he was a young monk, and while being there, got the chance to meet Master Miyazaki Senji. Thank you. I hope you're all feeling very powerful tonight, despite the challenging circumstances. And I would love to hear from you what you think power is, and any insights or comments you might have.
Nick.
Teresa, thank you for your Dharma talk, and I hope you're safe in Spain with all the outbreak numbers that have increased lately. I have a question about power, and my question is, where does power come from? Does it come from our own self-efforts, or does it come from outside of us?
Thank you for your question, Nick. I would also love to hear what you think. But regarding where power comes from, I think is a combination of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And I believe the deeper you go into your practice, the more connected you are to something that is really powerful and grounding. But the Buddha trip, as they say, is a long trip, so it's nice to have friends along the way. Thank you. Dave?
Thank you for your talk, Teresa. I was particularly struck by the idea of the Buddha for the 21st century being Sangha. I've never heard that idea expressed before, and I'm wondering if there's any more that you can say about that, particularly how it might relate to your theme of power.
Yeah, it's beautiful to think about it, right? That it will be a community, that the next Buddha will be a community. And the way it relates to my talk is, I think the world needs so much love and compassion and understanding, that a collective, a group of people will be able to, in that sense, to have much more of an impact than just an individual. I like what you said once. It really stayed with me. Or I don't know if it was you or Umar who said that when we sit zazen, we are quiet in the chattering in our mind. And when we sit together at Sesshin with, you know, our Sangha, is a way to quiet down that chattering collectively and together connect at a deeper level. So I think there's a lot of power, as we know, I think very well, in the fact of group of us coming together and connecting and supporting each other. Thank you. What do you think, Dave? How could we be the Buddha of the future? Sangha.
You know, it's interesting to think about that in the sense of there's always, of course, the intimate connection between Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the triple treasure. And so, in a way, this observation isn't so much something, you know, out of the blue as it is just saying, well, there's perhaps a subtle shift in that relationship between Buddha and Sangha, based on the circumstances of the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all, I'm sure, are familiar with the saying that Buddhism is like water. When you pour the water into a new vessel, it takes on the shape of the vessel. And when Buddhism is in the context of a society, it takes on the shape that's needful to be effective in that society. So in that sense, a shift in the relationship between the elements of the triple treasure based on the rather remarkable speeding train of societal change that we're embarked upon. It's not surprising that such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I remember there's a statement in one of the books by Stephen Batchelor where he says, people sometimes try to talk about the essence of Buddhism aside from its role in any given society. And he said he believes that that's meaningless, that really Buddhism inherently is something that's engaged with a particular society. And so when we have Zen in the West, and in the West in the 21st century, we have to be alert to the needs and opportunities for this kind of evolution and not simply, you know, be too lazy and stuck in the past to open our eyes to this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the current situation really calls for a more engaged approach. Thank you.
Vanessa?
I was thinking about what you said, Teresa, about power is something you don't know you have. And I had that thought the other day. I was looking at some old photos of myself from like 20 years ago and just seeing the power of 20-year-old me like came through in a picture in a way that shocked me. You know, I was like, wow, I couldn't see that then. And I couldn't see what power somebody in their 20s has. I guess you have a different kind of power for every stage of your life. But, and it's something that maybe you can only see in retrospect. My question is, how do you differentiate power from strength?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I associate more strength with physical strength. And power in this context, in the context that in the context that happened during this conference, in our spiritual context, I guess I related more that something that is unshakable, and also what this abbot from Aheji described about, you know, the law of nature, how flowers bloom at the same time, how insects start their activity at the same time every year, year after year. And to think that we are part of that too, you know, of that flow of life, and that this continuous practice is bound to support itself. So if we are this summer, we will be this fall. If we are this fall, we will be this winter, and so on. I guess that.
Teresa, thank you for your talk. I think power is a really important topic because we have so many mixed messages about power, and we're not supposed to want power, but actually we do need power to be effective in our lives. And I actually remembered something from one of your previous talks where you said that you were applying for a job and your boss made it seem like there was only one role and either you or this other woman would get it. And they did that to try to make you work harder or something, but it caused problems in the relationship. And then when you found out, oh, actually there's positions for both of us, we both have the job, then things got better, right? And that story stuck in my mind because it's so symbolic of how dysfunctional Silicon Valley is with all of the unnecessary competition. But I think a lot of that actually carries over to the spiritual realm as well and spiritual practice. And when people feel pitted against each other or like we have to decide who's best or fit for the role, it feels like a huge distraction from the real practice of actually working together and supporting each other in practice, which is that community, sangha, power of the community. So not sure exactly what my question is, but I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, like you know, your experience in the working world and how that experience might apply to the spiritual world in terms of how we relate to each other, like, you know, sharing power, I guess.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, that was an interesting story with my when I started working as a young reporter, you know, and the managing director just did it to make us work really hard. But we always played a fair game. We never were disloyal or did anything wrong in order to get the job, as I said. And yeah, we became best friends. Interesting. We both got the job. I think, you know, this. Of course, there's power in the real world or in the, as you said, in the labor market, right? There's so many things. And I had another editor once. She was a master in manipulating our egos as journalists. And I was seeing that. I saw that. I saw that she was manipulating my ego and everybody's ego, but I couldn't avoid it, you know, because I wanted it so much to get certain assignments or go on certain trips, you know. So for me, what is a relief is of course, we have to operate in the real world, right? But it's a relief to think that there is a power that nobody can remove from you, you know? And also, I also got less attached to achievement or those things that I was more attached when I was younger. And I care more about, I remember I used to do a Google search about my stories and how many hits were they published. Wow, a lot of suffering with all of that. I don't know how you can be able to just, I guess it's what we were talking a few weeks ago, that, you know, if you are not attached to the results, you just do it fully, completely, and you just forget about the other parts. It's difficult though, you know, it's difficult. I mean, I love my job and my career as a journalist, but I suffer because I was so attached to it and I wanted it so much and I care so much about it. So that made it wonderful, but also a source of pain. Yeah. It's good to work together. It's good to work together for sure. I guess to remove the ego is the work of, it takes a lot of work, I guess. I don't know what it takes to get deeper in the practice. But I know that you have struggled quite a bit with the power in Silicon Valley, power dynamics. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Craig.
Thank you so much, Teresa. It's always lovely to hear you even from so far away and to hear everybody else as well. The thoughts that came to my mind when you were talking, and actually hearing a lot of the discussion afterwards as well, is about power and about Buddha, both through space and through time. And the idea of Buddha as Sangha, and is about a collection of people, feels like kind of people and Buddha distributed through space. Then the phrase about all Buddhas 10 directions 3 times, or all Buddhas of past, present, and future. I often find that very kind of comforting and inspiring to remember that although we're trying to kind of live in the present moment, it is part of this kind of infinite continuum of time. And you talked about like 100 years ago when Zen first came to America, or lectures in Tassajara in the 70s, or your first steps towards meeting a Zen teacher, or the recurring cycle of flowers blooming and insects buzzing. There just seems to be, like, it comes up a lot, this idea of things happening through time. And it made me think that perhaps maybe this is also related to the power versus strength thing. Maybe strength is something that you have, but power is something that moves through you. It's not so much like a static thing that you hold and wait, you know, to deploy. Power is situational, and it can only happen over time. Because the power that you hold, that you influence now, has its effect, you know, in the future and over time, for good or bad. So I don't really have a question. I just wanted to share the thoughts that your talk inspired. And I guess the Buddha as Sangha thing, I also do find very thought-provoking and quite inspiring as well. It's a lovely notion to consider.
Thank you, Craig. I love how you always connect these talks to some part of the chants. That, of course, you have now memorized very well after all those Saturday services for months and months. Yeah, I think, I don't know, I have to keep thinking about it, about this power is something we don't know we have. It really stayed with me.
Giuseppe? Oh, sorry, I accidentally muted you. I tried to unmute. There you go.
Hi, Teresa. Thank you for your question, for your talk.
Hi, Giuseppe.
And can you hear me?
Yes.
Right. My question is, how do you practice without, how would you advise us to practice without getting a fascination for power? And I want to share my thought about power is similar, I think, to what you said in your talk, and that there is that power power is not relying on anything, and so not having power is relying on things, and having power is not relying on anything, and supporting the people around us, the situations. And I think in that sense, there is no difference between the more between a spiritual power and the practical power, you know, because I think the leader is always the one that the other people are relying on, and also it doesn't rely on situations, otherwise it wouldn't have leadership, true leadership. But so how do you avoid the fascination for power?
Thank you, Giuseppe. I'm glad that you're connecting to these talks too. How to avoid fascination with power in the context of practice? You know, once I was facing a personal difficulty when I first came to Kanondo. I think a lot of us come to practice with, you know, it was a challenging moment for me. Not terrible, but a little bit challenging. And then I had a conversation with Les one morning. And it's funny, I still remember that. And he told me, you know, when you get up in the morning, think, I am much larger than just Teresa. I am much larger than just Teresa. And I can still remember coming out of my apartment in Mountain View in the morning thinking that, you know, I'm just much larger than myself. And I think that's how I would talk about power. So it's not, you know, it wasn't about my power. Oh, power. I think that's a way to disconnect it from any fascination, because it's not really your power. It's this power that is larger, much larger than you, and you're part of it and being sustained by it. Even if you don't, if you haven't experienced it yet, if you don't feel it in your bones yet, you are part of that. So it's because it's not about you. For me, there is not the temptation of being fascinated by it, but supported, you know, by it. Thank you.
Sorry, Jayashree.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm not sure. Yes. Okay. Hi, Teresa.
Hi.
Thank you for your beautiful talk and for sharing all those experiences. I think as I was hearing you, first of all, it's so beautiful to think of power as coming from yourself. Because when we think about it in practical terms, it's always something external. You know, managers have power over their employees and compensation and all these very practical kinds of things. And it's always, I mean, when I look at it from an academic point of view, it's power is always from some external source, the role, the money, and so on and so forth. But here it's from within you. And that's very beautiful spiritual power coming from within you. But I wonder, to get back to Giuseppe's question, you know, the separation, is it because the power is from the practice as opposed to really, so it's within you, but it's more a function of the practice. And it's not, it's there. I mean, I've been trying to struggle with that. It's not really you. It's the practice ultimately. And it's just that because of the practice, you get this, what Vanessa was talking about is this inner strength. And then it spreads through the Sangha. And then there's this collective wisdom we all have, which is a power, but it's not ours.
Mm-hmm.
It's within us, but it's not ours. It's the practice that is giving it to us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you feel about that. So that's kind of my thought.
Thank you, Jaya. I'm not sure what your question is exactly, but is your question related to how practice empowers us, or?
Yeah, I was wondering if, and I don't know if it's a question or an observation, but is it really that it's us that have the power, or that it's the practice, and that we're just really, like you said, you talked about, well, you enjoy this, or you experience, when you describe the experience about being larger than yourself, of less telling you that. That was something really larger than you. And so yeah, it's within us, but is it, I guess maybe it's just semantics, maybe.
Okay.
Is it within us, or is it just something that's there and that we are able to?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
That we're just able to absorb it because of the practice. It's all around us.
Right. Yeah, I see what you
because
mean.
Because we practice. I mean, I find like when people have a practice like we do, we're so much stronger when we have to deal like all the challenges that we have to deal with and with people that have practical power over us.
Right.
But because of our practice, our spiritual practice, we have that, we're able to tap into that source.
Yes, now I understand what you mean. Yeah, I think I agree with that. It's ours and it's not ours. Right, thank you.
Diane?
Hi, Teresa. Oops, I have to unmute.
Oh, you're good.
Oh, you already unmuted me. Okay. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, Diane.
I know it's difficult for you to sit, as you've said, by yourself and being so far away, but I hope you know we're all sitting with you when you're sitting. We are with you. Thank you for your talk. A couple of key words you said, I think you said the collective and the community and the Sangha. And I'm trying to weave it together with that image of nature and how the flowers know when to bloom and the birds and the seasons. And it seems that when we together are expressing our nature, our true nature, then there's a power in that. And so that's the image that I got from your talk, that together when we are expressing our true nature, our Buddha nature, that collectively there's great power in that. Mm. It's like we're all kind of in tune with each other, and there's an energy that comes from that. So I'm thinking of power and energy, those two words. Mm. And I'm sure as I think about your talk over the next few days, more and more thoughts will be coming to me. So thank you. Thank you so much for stimulating a lot of thought and reflection.
Oh, thank you, Diane. I know that you have been you have been feeling very connected to nature recently. And, you know, I also like that image of, you know, flowers and insects and nature. It's just doing what it has to do and not thinking.
Mm.
So they don't know. They just bloom. They are not thinking, oh, I'm blooming. What does this mean? Am I connected with the insect? Is me and the insect the same? It's, you know, it's just, I like that line from the Grass Hut, from Sekito Kissin, where he says, let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. There's something in that line that I like. I feel like, you know, we need to let go and relax completely. Yeah, there's something powerful in coming together, that's for sure. I don't know exactly what it is. Maybe we don't know. Or maybe some people know and others don't know. There's this thing about Zen practice, you know, that you always feel that there's something that some people know and you don't know yet, and that you can know it. So, but yeah, there is something powerful when we come together, when we sit together. And, you know, about myself and sitting, I thought recently about what Brenda said in one of her talks. She mentioned that her daughter had a pillow, a meditation pillow, sitting in a wardrobe somewhere, you know, and she was not using it. So I have been putting my pillow in different places in the house, but eventually it's like, you know, they say all the roads lead to Rome. So for me it's the same. Eventually, you know, I end up sitting. And it helps, you know, the Dharma has been very sustaining, because when I read these stories or you know, I see these teachers of old time sitting, I get inspired. So I need, it's good to find sources of support. But I'm sitting again. That's good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Teresa.
Hi, Columbine. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Nice to see you. I'm well.
Nice
thank
to
you.
See you. Yeah.
I really like your explanation about how to Giuseppe, about how to not get caught up in it, because it's really something that is, I guess it's not something that we own necessarily, but I wonder, like, I was wondering what the opposite of power is. And I was wondering, like, is it weakness? And I wonder, it seems like weakness in Buddhism would be like yearning for something, wanting something, and in turn suffering. So I'm just wondering, I mean, is power just basically everything we're taught in Buddhism not to want things?
Sorry, what do you say? The last part is not to want things?
Well, I guess I'm just wondering, one way to look at power would be to look at, like, what's the opposite of power? And I don't know what that is. I guess weakness, I guess.
But I'm trying to understand why would you want to know what's the opposite of power, if I may ask?
I guess it's one way to understand. I don't know, maybe my mind is twisted, but sometimes, like, for example, if you don't know the definition of a word, sometimes you'll look up the antonym, you know? Like,
yeah,
you don't know what anxious means, so then you look up, well, what's the opposite of anxiety? And you see, oh, it's calm, you know? So it helps explain what you're wondering it is. So I guess it occurred to me, if you don't have power, or if you aren't powerful, what are you? Or would that help explain what it is to be powerful?
Yeah. I don't, you know, maybe in this context, I wouldn't want to talk about weakness. I don't think it's the opposite in this context with weakness. I think it's maybe, I'm seeing power in this context more like connection and understanding. So you always have that. You always have the power. It's impossible not to have it, right? It's like that every flower has that power. So we all have that. We all are part of that. So I guess maybe it would be the opposite, feeling disconnected, maybe. Not having a sense of connection. In this context, I guess. But that wouldn't be weakness.
May I ask, do you feel more powerful as you've gotten older?
Yes.
Okay. Then I have some.
Without any doubt.
Okay, good. Well, I was wondering, because Vanessa said she felt so powerful when she looked at pictures of her younger self. And so, you know.
Well, Vanessa has always been super powerful. Yeah, for sure. That part of also having, being less attached, is, for me, gives me enough power. But, yeah.
I just wanted to ask a quick question related to that. I mean, just, would the word be ignorance? Because, Teresa, when I was listening to you, you said that the power is really our awareness and understanding. So if we're not aware and understanding our own power, then that would mean that we're ignorant. Yeah,
it's true. But tonight, I kind of feel like using nice words, kind words.
Ignorance has such a...
So ignorance is so harsh.
Got it. Okay.
And we thought everything is going on within it. I think we all... Nice words are like soothing, you know? So this connection is not so hard on us. You know, we don't have to make it harder. It's quite hard already right now.
Peter?
Thank you, Teresa.
Hi, Peter.
As we've been talking about this, I keep thinking about Mahatma Gandhi. Vanessa, when you asked what's the difference between power and strength, I'm not sure exactly why, but immediately Gandhi came to mind, and I've just been reflecting on that through all of this, and finding this inspiration in power rooted in connection and interconnectedness and our common humanity, and finding that connection also to what you were expressing, Teresa, about you're so much more than Teresa. We're all so much more than ourselves. I'm reminded of a couple of stories from Gandhi's life. One particularly, his last fast, which was very right near at the very, very end of his life in Delhi, when there was rising tension between the Hindu and Muslim populations in India. It was immediately after the end of colonial British rule and the partition between India and Pakistan, and Gandhi saw the rising tension between the Hindu and Muslim populations in Delhi, and he brought an incredible power to that moment by expressing the anguish that he felt in seeing that disconnection between people, by expressing that anguish he saw, by bringing it onto his own body by fasting, and bringing suffering onto his own body, and demonstrating and bringing to everyone an awareness of the connection between all of them. I think by bringing suffering onto himself, he demonstrated to everyone else in the city the connection that they had with each other, and the anguish of the disconnection that they were hurtling towards. At the time in Delhi, the papers carried every day reports on his health from the doctors. And I think within 5 or 6 days, there were 2-3 million people signing peace pledges. And it really, really changed the course of history, really. And if this example came to mind immediately in the difference between power and strength, Gandhi, this little frail old man, literally starving himself, getting weaker and weaker and weaker, in many ways, kind of the opposite of strength, maybe strength in fortitude, maybe strength in his own dedication, but the incredible power in just demonstrating humanity and demonstrating connection, so much larger than himself. So it's been very inspiring. Thank you. Thank you, and thank you, everyone, for this wonderful conversation.
Beautiful. Beautiful, Peter. Thank you for thank you for sharing your insights and, you know, the reactions that came to you as a result of tonight's conversation. Yes, very powerful image of lack of physical strength, but still a lot of power. Thank you. Les, how are you? It's nice to see you tonight.
Oh, I'm fine, thank you.
Good. Anything you would like to share with us tonight?
Oh, no, I think enough's been said.
Yeah. Good. Well, it's very nice to see you and see that you're well.
Final questions before we close tonight? Okay. Dave, you have some questions.
This wasn't a question. It just relates to what Colleen was saying about the historic definitions of power that tend to be male and macho and aggressive. Whenever I hear the word power, I think, I don't know how many of you are old enough to have watched the old Dallas TV series back in the 80s, but there was an amazing interaction between a couple of the characters there where young Bobby Ewing was being chewed out by his dad for not taking care of some problem at the big oil company. He said, but daddy, you never gave me the power to do that. And gruff old Jock Ewing turned to him and he said, son, power isn't something somebody gives you, it's something you take.
Maybe that is the opposite of spiritual power. Thanks, Dave.
This talk was brought to you by the Canandoe Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canandoe.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.